analyzing what's wrong with current views of the Constitution. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. Along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, our fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be back with you, Barry.
Well, it's great to be back here with you as well, Chuck. On yesterday's program, we were starting to talk about the remarkable filibuster that was launched by United States Senator from Kentucky, Rand Paul, against the nomination of John Brennan to be the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Well, Senator Paul brought this filibuster action as a result of an exchange he had had prior to that with United States Attorney General, the head of the Department of Justice, Attorney General Eric Holder, where Attorney General Holder was not exactly, shall we say, convincing or reassuring to Senator Paul and his questions regarding whether or not they would see that it would be okay to use drones, unmanned aerial aircraft, which are fitted for war, against United States citizens on United States soil. And so, having received what is by now, by all intents and purposes, an invasive answer, basically saying, well, the president has no intention to bomb any specific territory. This is, well, hypothetically, we might have to do something, but we have no intention of doing it. But he says, but Holder did acknowledge that, well, yes, the president can authorize the use of lethal military force within the U.S. Wait a minute. Okay, now we got to stop and think about this for a minute. And those of us who are concerned and love the Constitution realize that we're starting to see red flags come up. And I think Senator Paul did rightly as well. And he wanted some clarification. He wanted it in writing. He wanted clear, unambiguous answer, no, we won't do this, in writing. Well, he spent almost 13 hours, Jeff, doing a filibuster. Blocked the nomination of John Brennan, at least for the day, and raised the ire of a number of folks, including some of his fellow senators, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, to name a couple who have been very vociferously vocal about their lack of taste for what Senator Paul has done. But I think that's kind of been drowned out by the rousing chorus of cheers from many other senators and from many his constituents and people all across the country who are saying it's about time somebody stood up and did what was right. Well, good deed ever goes unpunished, Charles. And so that's where the Journal of Record for the conservatives, or supposedly not for conservatives, but for the Republican Party comes in. And that would be the Wall Street Journal. Well, the Wall Street Journal decided they are going to side on the side of the McCain-Graham viewpoint that Senator Rand Paul actually was just droning on about drones, as they put it, and said that it was great showmanship, but his reasoning was bad because the Wall Street Journal is going to be the official arbiter of what is and isn't constitutional. But, however, in looking at a piece that was written by the Wall Street Journal about their arguments against Senator Paul, I think we find a number of, well, shall we say, flaws in their argument.
Oh, well, they're fantastic flaws in the argument. And what's interesting about this is that Gary North and the Tea Party economist basically dismantles this piece in the Wall Street Journal in a piece that we're going to be running a link to. It's called Wall Street Journal Defends Killing Americans with Drones. Basically, this possibility, this quote-unquote distant possibility of drones being used inside the United States to attack American citizens who may or may not have ties to Al-Qaeda or other groups like that, isn't particularly theoretical at all. Drones are already being used in the United States. The only difference is, in the United States, so far, now again, I say so far, have not been armed. At least, not that we know of. But, Barry, this program is so super secret that we would not find out they were armed until well after the fact. In fact, I would expect the government to deny, 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 deny until such time it became undeniable. And then they'd say, well, yes, but we had to do that to protect the American public.
Oh, similar to hand cases and cases of fully automatic firearms to the Mexican drug cartels. rounds.
Exactly. With no tracking, with no ability to track those rifles, except when they're captured at places where they've been used to commit crimes, which is exactly what happened during the Fast and Furious program. So we see what Eric Holder's promises and his word is worth. It's not worth anything. And yet, the Wall Street Journal comes out and sides with Holder on this. The question is, as I asked yesterday, yes, Eric Holder has come out and said that non-combatants could not be attacked. Okay, then what about combatants who were so-called combatants who were U.S. citizens? There's a question here. Who decides, first of all, that they're combatants, and who constitutionally is supposed to decide they're combatants? Well, those two things have two different answers.
Yes, they do.
These guys are arguing in favor of the president being the final decider who are combatants. And, of course, that is actually left up to Congress. And we talked yesterday about letters of marque and letters of reprisal and how they would be used. Now, those things are not designed to be used on U.S. soil. Those things are designed to be used in international-type activities against pirates, against people who are hiding in nations who deny that they're there, but there isn't enough evidence to really declare war against that particular nation, or the nation is in such chaos that declaring war against it would essentially be a waste of time because there is no government entity left anymore to declare war against, which is actually, in some cases, some of the places in, like in the Middle East, that is the case. Yemen being one, it's basically chaos there. You know, what good would it do us to declare war against the nation of Yemen for harboring some of these guys in Al-Qaeda? Okay, so who is supposed to decide who combatants are? Well, Barry, who is the power to declare war left to?
It is specifically spelled out that it's Congress's authority to declare war.
And whose job is it to issue letters of marque and letters of reprisal?
Again, I have to respond, sounding like a broken record, Congress.
Okay, so logically, whose job is it to determine who combatants are?
And for the trifecta, Congress.
Congress. Now, there are, let's not kid ourselves, the reason that the President of the United States is the Commander-in-Chief is that in an emergency situation, say Congress is out of session, or there's an immediate attack on the soil of the United States.
Or the Capitol building has been burned to the ground, etc.
Yeah, exactly. The president is left at discretion to gather the military forces and make the initial actions for, quote-unquote, defense. Not to take offense. Now, we've all heard the saying that the best defense is a good offense.
Correct.
And vice versa, the best offense is a good defense, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is, the president is not to use the army offensively as his own private little military force.
Right.
It isn't. What it's for is for the immediate defense of the United States until such time as Congress can be gathered to deliberate on what is the best course of action to take on this issue.
Correct.
So, what's Eric Holder arguing in favor of?
Well, he's arguing the imperial presidency. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's interesting, Chuck, because, you know, I think maybe we need to write an op-ed through the Wall Street Journal to kind of help them through their constitutional muddle thinking, because after acknowledging that Eric Holder has basically said, well, we don't have any intention, but hypothetically, we can use lethal military forces in the U.S., and in chiding Rand Paul, and they say this, and I quote from the Journal's article, calm down, Senator, Mr. Holder's right, even if he doesn't explain the law very well. So now the Wall Street Journal is going to go on to explain the law for us better than Eric Holder did. And I quote, the U.S. government cannot randomly target American citizens on U.S. soil or anywhere else. What it can do under the laws of war, the laws of war, what happened to the Constitution? Well, we'll go back to that in a minute.
That's right.
What it can do under the laws of war is target a, quote, enemy combatant, unquote, anywhere at any time, including on U.S. soil. This includes a U.S. citizen who is also an enemy combatant. The president can designate such a combatant if he belongs to an entity, a government, say, or a terrorist network like Al-Qaeda, or maybe like Al-Cupcake, I don't know, that has taken up arms against the United States as part of an internationally recognized armed conflict. Well, Chuck, that sounds perfectly plausibly logical, right?
It would if it didn't fly in the face of the United States Constitution.
Ah, but you see, but we're not arguing the Constitution from the Wall Street Journal's point of view. We've now gone beyond the Constitution to the, quote, laws of war, unquote. And I guess the laws of war, Chuck, trump the United States Constitution. Now, that's interesting because when I look at Article 6, it says that this Constitution is the supreme law of the land. This Constitution and the laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof, and treaties made under the authority of the United States. I didn't see the law of war supersede all of the above anywhere in Article 6 of the Constitution, or anywhere else for that matter.
No, and in fact, the laws of war are only law if they've been duly passed by the United States Congress, signed by the President, and they comport with the United States Constitution. All those are in question here. The laws of war appear to be basically the President declaring that he has the power, and Congress saying, yeah, I guess maybe you do, and the court failing to intervene. None of those guarantee the constitutionality of something. And therein lies the problem. We're doing an apples and oranges comparison here. We're talking about basically what amounts to imperial law. The United States of America is not an empire, or at least it's not supposed to be. It's a republic. It's supposed to be a government of laws. Now, the law has a specific method of being made, and that is passed by Congress, signed by a president, and enforced by a president. That's not what's going on here. That's not what the Wall Street Journal is talking about. They're talking about this imperial entity that has passed down approximately since the Civil War, where the president essentially seizes war powers and Congress doesn't do anything to stop him. That doesn't mean it's constitutional.
Well, you see, we're extra constitutional now, Chuck, and I think the Wall Street Journal and many of our United States senators like it that way, because that way you can blame somebody else.
Oh, exactly.
If we get into a war, well, it's the president's fault. He was the one who declared it. Wait a minute. That's our job. Nope. We abrogated that. We gave it to him. Take your Constitution, cut out that phrase from Article 1, Section 8, and then go paste it over into Article 2. See, now it's his. Well, wait a minute. We killed Americans on American soil. Well, the president had a secret list, and he declared them an enemy combatant. Well, who helped him make that list? Well, we don't know. It's secret. But was he right? Well, we'll never know because they basically blew him up in such a way that there wasn't much of his body left, like they did to Anwar al-Awlaki. So what did he do? Well, you know what? He was checking out books from the library that we found to be suspicious, that could have tied him to some kind of an entity or some kind of a terrorist network, which, Chuck, we've seen has happened before where the government wants to have copies of your records of where you go online and what books you check out of the library or what things you buy so that they can create a dossier to say, well, this person has a high tendency of potentially being affiliated with a terrorist network.
Well, Barry, you realize there are people who have gotten themselves on alert lists by simply stopping in the local 7-Eleven that happens to be owned by an Al-Qaeda operative, you know, somewhere inside the borders of the United States and getting a cup of coffee every morning because they're being surveilled by the FBI and Homeland Security because they're suspected of sending money back to wherever in the Middle East. And somebody who stops in and buys a newspaper and a cup of coffee every day suddenly gets on a watch list because they drink coffee and read newspaper at a place they bought it from because it was convenient on their way to work or on their way back home or wherever. This is the kind of thinking that we've devolved into. Everybody is automatically a suspect.
Yes, and the Wall Street Journal does this with some panache, Chuck, because they keep going on here and trying to, as they say, you know, if you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you do is you stop digging. No, they actually went from a spade to a backhoe to continue to dig this hole.
Yeah, exactly.
And so what they started was, okay, they said, well, if such a conflict exists, this is this quote-unquote, internationally recognized armed conflict. Such a conflict exists between the U.S. and Al-Qaeda. So I guess as long as those two entities recognize they're in conflict with each other, that's internationally recognized. Is that it, Chuck? I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's been any, you know, and I hate using the term United Nations continuing resolutions saying that the Al-Qaeda is intentionally attacking the United States. As a matter of fact, you'd have probably gotten a bunch of the other countries to sign on with Al-Qaeda if that were the case.
I was going to say, you would not get a unanimous resolution out of either the Security Council or the General Assembly of the United Nations.
Yeah, exactly. And again, why is it that it has to be internationally recognized? If the United States Congress recognizes it and says, we are at war with this country or this organization, and they pass that in Congress, then that is all that takes to be recognized. All of a sudden now the Wall Street Journal is saying, well, you know, Congress, not only do you have to cede your authority to the president, but even the president has to cede a little bit to the approbation of foreign countries. So if a foreign country won't recognize it, then it's not legitimate. Now, I'm wondering, is that going to stop the president? I don't think so. But then they keep going, and they say, well, so Mr. Holder is right that the U.S. could have targeted, say, U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki had he continued to live in Virginia. So in other words, the Wall Street Journal are saying, well, as long as we think it's an okay war, they can kill people on American soil regardless. Now, then the journal does something that I think is really, really, well, gets back to yellow journalism, Chuck.
Okay, let me
go ahead.
I will give them the benefit of the doubt in this. I think most journalists are too stupid. Pardon me, and you kick me if you will. But most journalists are too stupid to go back and actually research this kind of stuff. And I think somebody told somebody this, and they just wrote it down
They bit like a fish. That's right. And here's the line that they use in the Wall Street Journal, Chuck, which basically got my bile up. The U.S. killed him in Yemen before he could kill more Americans. There's only one problem with that line, Chuck. There's never been any proof, conclusive or otherwise, that ties Anwar al-Awlaki, a United States citizen, with the death of any American.
There are some documents, supposedly, that quote-unquote tie him to Al-Qaeda and the fact that he's moved to Yemen and hooked up with some of these people. But again, here's the problem, Barry. He's a United States citizen who was denied the right to trial by jury.
Absolutely. But so the Wall Street Journal, hey, if we can keep him from killing people, it's okay to take him out without any due process. Not whatsoever. Who cares if he's an American citizen? Ah, yeah, he's one of them, so we're going to just go blow him away. But then they say this. They say, but under the law, now, which law is this? Is this the laws of war, or is this the United States Constitution, how they're talking about, Chuck? But under the law, Al-Awlaki was no different than the Nazis who came ashore on Long Island in World War II, were captured and executed. Well, there's just one big problem with that, Chuck. The Nazis were foreign enemies, foreign agents of a foreign country who were invading the country. Anwar al-Awlaki was still a United States citizen who had left the country.
Well, hold on. There's another layer to that. They were enemy combatants with a declared war against them by the United States Congress.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Which does not exist in the case of Al-Qaeda. We are not at what you cannot declare war against an entity that is not a national entity.
Well, and it's interesting because Gary North actually, he spells this out in his article, and he says, well, no different, really? Those spies were captured, tried, and executed. See, that's the word that the Wall Street Journal conveniently left out of their analysis, was the fact that they were tried and executed. He said, well, not all of them were executed. The government appointed seven generals to try the case in a military court because they had initially come ashore in military uniforms. There were 3,000 pages of trial transcripts. Two of the eight were given prison sentences. They were released early. But, hey, but there's no difference. So I guess keeping a secret list, having the CIA send a militarized drone to a foreign country and blowing away a U.S. citizen, and let's not forget, they also killed Alakwi's, I think it was 16-year-old nephew, who was also an American citizen, who was with him when the drone hit.
I think it was his son.
Actually, I thought it was a nephew, but maybe you're right. Maybe it was his son. We'll check that. We'll do our data checking here.
In any case, it doesn't matter.
Yes,
it was a male relative. Very close. Yeah, that's splitting hairs. But, of course, this is not the first time that this particular power has been abused. We've been using drones in Afghanistan or in Pakistan. And one of the reasons that the Pakistanis, who we're at peace with, by the way, are no longer very happy with the presence of the United States on Pakistani soil is the fact that we use drones to supposedly kill Al-Qaeda. And in fact, what we've done is accidentally kill wedding parties that had 50 people killed in them. That had happened in Pakistan. Someone was having a wedding party in an area where the United States government decided that nobody should have large gatherings, and they sent in drones and blew up the place. Well, that doesn't work for some nations. I think the United States would be very unhappy if, for some unknown reason, we were to allow Mexico to perform maneuvers on the soil of the United States, ostensibly to capture their own foreign nationals for removal, and they suddenly decide to use remote devices to blow up American weddings. You could see how that might tend to infuriate the local populations where this is happening. And in fact, this policy has created nothing but even more of what the United States is already dealing with, and that's blowback.
Yes.
Because the more these kind of tactics are used, the more anger it creates, the more resentment it creates. This is why Pakistan wants us out of Pakistan. And it's completely understandable to my way of thinking. You know, they let us in as a favor to help restore their government, and we have abused the authority. Basically, what has gone on here is that the Wall Street Journal has assumed a whole bunch of journalistic license and has abused that license, printing these stories that are, well, essentially, it's a just-so story. If you leave the details out about the Nazis who were captured, tried, and then executed, and not all of them executed, after a trial, and a trial in which there are extant, and you can get them, over 3,000 pages of trial transcripts. You can claim, okay, they were tried by a military court. Military courts in these cases tend to be very open and above board. They don't want there to be any question after the, at least that is until the 21st century. Let's put it that way. They tend to be open and above board to avoid any appearance of being a kangaroo court. Now, there's no question that these Nazis were captured on American soil. There's no question that they were, most of them were captured in out of uniform, which makes them automatically, by the rules of war, liable to be executed. There's no question that they came to sabotage in the role of combatant. Therefore, could they be tried and executed? Yes, they were. Now, I know something about this case. And the two guys who were not executed, A, were, believe it or not, American citizens.
Yes.
One of them was a citizen, and one of them had been raised since early childhood as an American and went back to Germany. And I think both of them turned state's evidence. It's been a while since I read the story of this particular thing. But the fact is, there's a whole lot of nuance and twists and turns that the Wall Street Journal is just ignoring, telling you a just-so story to make it look like Eric Holder was right. Ladies and gentlemen, Eric Holder is wrong. This is the act of an imperial presidency, and the president's henchmen basically rallying around him and claiming these powers. And now we have what amounts to one of the establishment newspapers saying, oh, yes, of course, the president has this power. No, he does not.
Well, Chuck, it's not like this is going to be the last of this. We're going to be seeing quite a bit of this. Now, the sad part about it is that we have many people in many states, and we've talked about this before, including Ohio, lining up to be places where we can test out these unmanned aerial aircraft. And, you know, we want to get in on it because of jobs, et cetera, and all the money that will come from it. Well, Charles, I do believe that, you know, just like any tool, these unmanned aerial aircraft do have some legitimate purposes. It's just that in the hands of those who believe they're above the law, or they're a law unto themselves, or the laws don't apply to them quite the way they apply to everybody else, then those tools can become destructive. Those tools can become weapons of destruction. And I guess, Chuck, I'm wondering at what point that the international community might turn on the United States and consider a weaponized drone that hits a wedding party, say in Pakistan, as a weapon of mass destruction.
Oh, sure, or an act of war, even if they have permission to do certain things. Stepping outside those limits could be construed as an act of war.
Very much so. And honestly think that it could very well be easily proven, given the rhetoric that has been put forth by people in this administration, whether it be Attorney General Eric Holder, whether it be spokesman for President Obama, whether it be the Secretary of State John Kerry or his predecessor Hillary Clinton. And, you know, and somebody posted up just the other day, it's going to have the ability to use a drone against American citizens on American soil who are enemy combatants, but we couldn't send a drone in to save four American citizens in Benghazi.
Well, why, that's an apples and oranges comparison, Barry. Don't you know that?
And oh, yes, argument. I know.
That's the argument from the administration.
Well, but you know what we get down to, Chuck, is that it really is a definite need for people to understand what the Constitution, what limitations the Constitution actually sets upon the actions of our governmental actors. Because people like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, who believe that, as Senator Paul put it, they believe the entire earth is a battlefield, and so therefore the laws of war apply everywhere, including on U.S. soil. You know, they have a view that the Constitution is just there for them to be able to justify their actions or excuse them if it turns out to be inconvenient. But if we have enough citizens, like a Senator Rand Paul, who prior to being a senator, obviously was a doctor in private practice in Kentucky, but who obviously grew up at the knee of one of the most constitutionally adept congressmen in history, and that being U.S. Congressman, former U.S. Congressman Ron Paul, that when we learn what the Constitution's actually supposed to do, how it's supposed to protect our liberties, how it's supposed to engender freedom for us, how it's supposed to limit the action of those governmental actors, how it is supposed to create the balances and the checks that were built into it, including checks upon the federal government by state governments. Once we realize how the operation is supposed to work, and then we see from these examples, especially with Senator Paul's courageous stand of bringing it all to light, because honestly, he didn't really care much about John Brennan one way or the other. His argument wasn't against Brennan. He needed to bring to national prominence this issue of using unmanned drones on the president's say-so, picking whoever they feel like to be a limit. That was the constitutional issue at hand. That's what Senator Rand Paul stood and discussed and filibustered for 13 hours to get people talking and learning and understanding that our constitutional liberties are under great deals of threat from governmental actors who believe that they're above that document. Chuck, well, that document is the organizing and limiting factor for a government.
Well, John Brennan was a good target because he has a long history of putting out information essentially about the right of the government to do this and do that, that simply are completely anti-constitutional. And in fact, he's being nominated to head an agency which has a long track record of abuse of their authority and abuse of the United States Constitution. So he really could not have picked a better target. And what's sad about that is that some people who were recently candidates for president of the United States have come out and disparaged someone who simply wanted to be able to protect the rights of United States citizens to be able to expect trial by jury and protection of their liberties by the United States government rather than the United States government chucking everything and saying this man has committed a treasonous act. Well, treason has to be proven in a court. And in fact, Barry, it has a very high standard for conviction. You can't even bring a case of treason unless you can provide at least two witnesses to the treason. It's an absolute requirement.
Yes, it is. I believe. Article 3, Section 3, I believe.
Article 3, Section 3. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. That is a very high standard. No circumstantial evidence allowed. You have to present witnesses to testify, or you have to exact a confession in open court. Period. And it has to be to one of those crimes listed on that list. Now, could you make a case that Anwar al-Awlaki committed treason? Well, you'd have to prove it in a court of law, and it sure looks like he might have been able to. But again, we don't know because there's never been a trial. And that's the bottom line here. You cannot deem someone to have committed treason. There is a law that requires that they be convicted of that crime. And what Lindsey Graham and John McCain have done is come out and said, the Constitution be hanged. These men are traitors. And John McCain, who's been basically plying on this rapidly deflating currency of him being a war hero for years, that bank is just about empty. Because you're now acting like the people who held you prisoner for...
That's right.
I don't know what it was, 5, 6 years, something like that. So, really, what makes us superior to our enemies if we act just like our enemies? Nothing. In fact, it makes us just like them. And that's the problem here.
But that's where we're heading to as a country, Chuck. And that's the reason why we have to have constitutional education. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm hitting that very hard because if you listen to us for any length of time whatsoever, you know that that is a issue that is near and dear to both my heart and to Chuck's. So much so that we spend a lot of our time teaching classes on the Constitution, how to think through these things constitutionally. Our Institute on the Constitution classes, now, I say our, I just mean the ones we teach, because Institute on the Constitution is a nationally recognized program based in Maryland, who is headed up by our good friend, Pastor David Whitney, and we work with them very closely to teach these the history and of the Constitution, and the document itself, what the words actually mean in context, and how to apply them to current contexts of our situation, such as this debate. And, you know, this, Chuck, this filibuster is an absolute lovely unit on how to go about utilizing the Constitution in the way it's intended to get to a result, because ultimately... And we're going to talk about that here in just a minute, a little bit. Rand Paul got an answer from the White House, from Attorney General Eric Holder, after the filibuster, in relation to his question about, can you give me assurances in writing that you are not going to be using these drones to target American citizens on American soil? Now, we'll talk about that in a minute, but what we're talking about right now is, he wanted to have a constitutional clarification by the Obama administration. That's what we should all be asking for, ladies and gentlemen. Every day, we should be keeping in contact with your elected officials, whether it's your congressperson or United States senator, or even if it's your local officials, whether it's your local city councilmen or your township trustees. You should get to know these people, ladies and gentlemen. See, that's the whole point. We could be an apathetic populace who allows people to make decisions for us and then get upset when we don't like the way the decisions are made. Or we can be engaged citizenry, and it doesn't take a whole lot. I mean, yes, we do have to step outside of our current comfort zone just a little bit, but it doesn't take an awful lot of effort to look up and find out, well, who represents, who's, if you live in a township, who's my township trustee? Or if you're in the city, well, who's the city councilman? And am I in a ward, or is it an at-large representation where any one of the city council people, like in the city of Columbus, could represent me, but probably don't, so I have to figure out where they live and figure out who's closest to me. But we can do that. It's easy to find your state representatives. You can go to our website at principalpolicy.com and link down and put in your, there's a link we have, and you can type in your zip code, and it'll pull up who your state rep and your state senator are. We've made it as simple for you as we possibly can. Same thing can happen at the U.S. congressional level. Now, honestly, most people don't really remember who their congressman is, but some people do. But you ought to get to know them. And I don't mean be buddy-buddy and have them over for brats and, you know, a cold one on the weekend, but at least know who they are, know what they're voting on. You know, pay attention to their voting, pay attention to what they say. If they're coming in the district and they're saying one thing and they're going back and voting a different way in Washington, D.C., you've got yourself a serious problem. But there are some serious solutions to that, and that's called education. And that's educating your neighbors, educating other voters, educating people on where these people stand. And when enough people realize that somebody is telling them one thing and doing something else, well, Chuck, I know human nature well enough, nobody likes that. And nobody's going to stand for that for too long unless they just don't feel that there's anything they can do about it. But the problem is that's a self-fulfilling defeatist mentality. There are many things you can do about it, and one is get yourself educated. Two is educate others, and three is work your tail off when it comes time to find another candidate or to vote out the person who is lying to you.
Well, that's what the problem has been now for decades. You know, we're doing a little talk now. We're running a thing. You know, we run more than one educational opportunity. We teach these Institute on the Constitution classes. Barry, as of last Thursday, we also opened registration for Camp American for this year. Now, we always talk about how we need to get young people involved in this battle. And one of the best ways to do it is to send them to Camp American. Ladies and gentlemen, I will not kid you. We want to teach your kids about this. And we're running a summer camp where we can teach them some of these advanced level things. And we can do it at a price that is, some people squawk about the price, you know, $250 to bring a kid in, give him 4 hours of instruction a day on advanced topics related around the United States Constitution, constitutional and Christian worldview governance. 4 classes a day, 4 hours a day, and then he gets the whole afternoon full of recreation. After lunch, they get recreation all afternoon till 6 o'clock. So what do they get to do? They can go boating. They can go skiing. They can go tubing. We have bowling. We have go-karts. We have roller skating. We have hiking. You can even, if you really want to go down and spend the money, you can go horseback riding on these old plugs and they drag you through the park. It's really not a very exciting ride. But nonetheless, that's available if you want it. You can go paddle boating. You can go putt-putting. There's all kinds of stuff. The kids have a blast, and they also learn something. Now, Barry, this, for the second year in a row, we're doing something that we haven't done in years past. It's always kind of been available. We haven't pushed it. But that is, this camp is also open to adults. If you can take the accommodations, and let's just say that they are rustic, there is electricity and not much else.
They're not too bad once you get past the first night, Chuck. I'll give you that. I've now been at camp now, what, eight years?
No, it's longer than that.
With my family?
Yeah. This is our 13th year.
Okay, so yeah, it's been longer than that. But a number of years, maybe at least 10 years, I've been coming to camp with my family. And you know what? Every year, you know, if you just think about packing for camp, you can make it a great, great experience. And each year, more and more of the group camp that we stay in gets updated and somewhat modernized.
Yeah, and somewhat being the operative phrase.
Well, yes.
but again, we would like to invite you. It's www.campamerican.com. And, Barry, we also have another major announcement that we failed to make on yesterday's program.
Oh, yes, we did, but I'm glad we saved it for Saturday.
Yes, me too. Now,
well, Chuck, I think it's a great thing about camp, but we also have something coming up, and you're right, we forgot to talk about it yesterday, but we're going to talk about it today. Mark on your calendars, ladies and gentlemen, the weekend of April the 25th through the 27th, that's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, of April this year, because the Institute for Principled Policy, one of the sponsors of this program, is proud to host a spring conference with a very special speaker. That speaker is Pastor Joe Moorcraft of Chalcedon Presbyterian Church in Cumming, Georgia. Now, Joe Moorcraft, Chuck, I know you know of him as well. Many others do as well. He is probably one of the country's foremost historians on church history and the impact of the church upon Western culture, both historically and current. And we are happy to have been able to land Pastor Moorcraft for a speaking engagement. And so we're going to be having our conference. It's actually going to start on Friday morning on the 26th. The 25th is for those who want to become underwriters of the conference. We're having a private dinner with Pastor Moorcraft, with the board of the Institute, and with our underwriters. And we're going to be holding the conference starting Friday morning and going through midday Saturday at Grace Presbyterian OPC Church on Apostle Waite Road in Columbus, which is up near on the north end of town. You can go online at principledpolicy.com for more information or email us, and we will send you flyers that you can put out to your networks. But sign up now, because registrations are open right now, and we only have a certain amount of space that we have at the church that we're using. So when we run out of space, we are going to be closing registrations. But it is a very engaging, and it's into our radio, and you can get near a computer, Google up his name and listen to a couple of his sermons. He is a really engaging speaker who teaches history, church history, theology, ethics, you name it, and does so in such a winsome way. We are just incredibly pleased to be able to have him here to talk about the engaging the world for Christ. That's the theme of our conference this year.
And that's a great theme. And it's interesting that we're doing this. You know, this is the kind of the first thing that Institute for Principled Policy is doing this year. And that is this conference of Sepper Referenda, engaging the world for Christ. But the second thing you're doing is Camp American.
Oh, yeah.
Because the Institute for Principled Policy, not exactly the official sponsor of that, but they're one of the sponsors of Camp American, because Camp American is a standalone entity. We're a nonprofit. But the Institute for Principled Policy is always heavily involved in that. For instance, Sasha Volacord, who's coming to teach, is on the board of the Institute for Principled Policy. He's an Austrian economist. Barry Sheets, some guy named Barry Sheets, I don't know who he is, the director of the Institute for Principled Policy, he's going to be teaching this year. Normally I teach, but this year we got so many teachers, I get the year off. However, one thing I should mention, Barry, and this is very important.
Yes, sir.
One of our speakers on our list who may not be coming this year. We don't know for sure. We don't have confirmation. I don't even know for sure what happened to him, but I know that one of our speakers, Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center, that's Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center, AmericanPolicy.com, AmericanPolicyCenter.com, has been taken ill. We don't know details. The last thing I heard was that he had come off of a ventilator. To come off of one means you had to have been on one, and being on a ventilator is not a good thing. It's usually an indicator of some kind of heart or circulatory issue. So we don't know what's happened to Tom. We are not in a position really to find out. We only find out what is being communicated to us, and he may not be at camp, so I may get pressed back into service. And I always have a couple of classes hanging around in the background ready to be used. There's a couple of classes I haven't taught in, I don't know, 4 or 5 years that really need to be taught. But that being said, this is a great opportunity for you to come out and meet people and shake hands. As the Reprimanda Conference is, it's a great opportunity to come out and mingle and network and meet people with a similar mindset, and especially to meet and mingle with Pastor Joe Moorcraft, who really is just a spectacular presenter. The man knows history inside and out, especially church history. He does a 48-part sermon. 48 parts, 48, apparently 48 weeks he spent on this, on the Reformation, the history of the Reformation. And believe it or not, you can get that at sermonaudio.com. If you do a search on Joe Moorcraft III, you can get a number of, he's got, I think, hundreds of sermons available on Sermon Audio. And some of the people that we're dealing with at camp may not be found on Sermon Audio, but they are brilliant speakers and brilliant teachers in the liberty and Christian worldview arena. And these two are great people. And if you come to camp, this is not something where you get them in an academic environment where they're down on the floor. They talk to you for an hour and then they disappear. When these guys come and speak at camp, they're at camp. They're campers, baby. You can come in. You can interact with them. You can have conversations with them. You can ask them questions. You can eat dinner with them. You can eat lunch with them. You can eat breakfast with them. We have no one who's so snobby that they don't come down to camp and mingle with the campers. These are great guys. And this year's list, Tom DeWeese, if he's able to come, and if not, I will take his place. We have Pastor David Whitney from the Institute on the Constitution, who does some great lecturing on things like the jury, the fully informed jury. He does things on the federal land grab. He does things on the oaths, a lecture on oaths, on marriage, on several of these kinds of issues. We have Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America. I mean, how many people have heard about Larry Pratt's run-in with Piers Morgan on Piers Morgan Live? And Piers Morgan, I have to laugh about this, Barry. Piers Morgan still thinks he won that confrontation.
Well, whether he won it or not, we're not inviting him to Camp American.
No, Piers Morgan is not invited to Camp American. Who else do we have? We have Joel McDermott.
Yes, Dr. Joel McDermott.
Joel McDermott is from American Vision. That's a Christian worldview education center. He has written a book called Restoring America One County at a Time. And, Barry, we should tell people that we are using that book in our class, in our Institute on the Constitution class that we're teaching.
Yes.
Barry, you and I were so impressed with that book. In fact, the minute I read the introduction, and this is what I told Joel McDermott when I called him to ask him to come to camp, said, you know, we decided your book was worth the price on the basis of the introduction. He said the introduction alone was worth the price of the book. That being said, he's coming to camp. He's going to talk to us about issues surrounding that. Trying to think who else is coming. Again, I'm this Barry Sheets guy, and we're not sure what he's teaching about.
He's not either.
Well, I need to know before too long so I can put it on a flyer. But, those speakers, that's a pretty solid group that we've put together to teach at Camp American. Well worth, Barry, if you get in on the early bird special, well worth the $250.
Yes, indeed.
Just for the activities you get, for the food, for the comradeship, for getting to meet the speakers, for being together. Basically, $250 cheap at twice the price. But it isn't twice the price. Until May 25th, it's $250. After May 25th, it's $300. And still, that's cheap. So, sign up. Please come out to www.campamerican.com and go out to our store. Visit our store. Visit the individual tuition packages if you're coming. If you're coming as a family, we invite that. Come as a family. That you will not get to share a cabin as a family. If you bring your children, they will be in a cabin with a counselor. That's just the way we have it set up. Don't get disappointed. Don't come to me and ask for a special dispensation. The answer will be no, because the kids compete in cabin competition. And part of the deal is creating this sense of friendship and comradeship that you get when you stay with other kids in a cabin. So come as a family, but don't expect to necessarily get a family cabin. That's not the way this works. But.
Well, one of the other things, Chuck, that they would be doing is we oftentimes, as we're teaching, and maybe if you're teaching this year or not, usually teach a class called, we lovingly call it the Baloney Detector, where you take an article or a document or somebody's statements, and we put them in front of students. We actually teach them about informal logic and logical fallacies, and then we give them some material and let them go to work. And so if they can figure out what the logical fallacies are. Well, Chuck, I'd love to do that class this year because we've got a perfect piece right now. And it is, since we've been talking about it during this program, it is the letter that Attorney General Eric Holder sent in reply to Senator Rand Paul's filibuster of Wednesday. Now, this was sent on Thursday, March the 7th. As a matter of fact, there's a photocopy of the letter up on a number of different websites. I'm looking at theweeklystandard.com. They've got a copy of the letter here from the Attorney General of Washington, D.C., signed by Eric Holder, Jr., addressed to the Honorable Rand Paul, and it says, "Dear Senator Paul, it has come to my attention that you have now asked an additional question." Quote, "Does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat on American soil?" Unquote. The answer to that question is no. Sincerely, Eric Holder. Okay? Well, Chuck, on first blush, and I think many of these websites and other pundits on first blush, they're saying, well, see, there you go. Rand Paul got what he was looking for. But if we were taking this and putting it through the baloney detector, Chuck, how would we break this down?
Oh, well, gosh, Barry, first of all, we would look for all the wiggle words and the wiggle phrases, and this actually has some dandy ones. Let me get that right in front of me real quick. Here it is. "It has come to my attention that you have now asked an additional question." Ho, 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 ho. What additional question? I believe this was part of the original question.
I do believe that it was part and parcel of Rand Paul's original interrogation, if you will, of Eric Holder before the committee a few days prior.
Now, again, let's go back into this. Does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat on American soil? Okay, where's the wiggle phrase in there, Barry?
Well, there's a number of things here, Chuck, but the whole idea is that engaged in combat. Who defines that?
Who defines it and how is it defined? If sitting around talking to someone who may or may not, not proven in a court of law, maybe a member of an organization that engages in or allegedly engages in some kind of terrorist activity, would that necessarily be considered an act of combat? Simply engaging in conversation with them. Or even conspiring openly with them.
Well, we would hope not, but that seems to be just about where the line was drawn for Al-Awlaki, because supposedly the main thing he was doing was conspiring. That's what got him killed.
Yes, exactly. He doesn't seem to have actually been involved in anything, although you never know. I have not read it that deeply in a long time. But that being said, this is where the wiggle room is. Well, he was engaged in combat. How was he engaged in combat? He was engaged in conversation with people who are engaged in combat. Okay, wait a minute. Combat, to me, means holding something in your hand that is directed against a combatant on United States. And so, in other words, if you were shooting at someone who is a member of the armed forces or maybe law enforcement, although I don't even buy that, I believe that that is a criminal act, not necessarily an act of war, because you're not acting on at the behest of another country. You're operating at the behest of a criminal organization. That is not war, and that is not combat. That is criminal activity. This is the kind of thing that we try to teach people to understand. Now, does that mean they're not criminals and shouldn't necessarily be executed? No, we're not saying that at all. They should get a trial and have evidence presented. That's the bottom line here, Barry. That's what we want to see. And that's what we try to train people to recognize. Okay, I'm not sure the original question in this case was, does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat on American soil? So we may have a disagreement on what engaging in combat means. My guess is that the Justice Department, acting at the behest of the president, would interpret that as broadly as possible. My guess is that a constitutionalist looking at that would interpret that as narrowly as possible. Now, where does the truth lie? Well, frankly, I think it has to lie on the narrow interpretation, not on the broad interpretation, because you can cite so many of the writings of the founders where they said, well, could this creep in? Could this creep in? Could this creep in? The whole idea was to keep this kind of thing from creeping in, and the answer is we're not keeping that from creeping in. This is tyranny creeping in. A broadening of the definitions is tyranny.
Well, absolutely. There's no way around that. And Holder is definitely trying to save out some wiggle room. Now, I think it's interesting. Does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone? Well, no, he's not using it, Chuck. He's just authorizing it being used by the actor, whether it's the CIA or military or, well, perhaps it's Homeland Security. Who would be using these drones. Now, is the president using it? No. Would he authorize it? Well, he already has in many instances. You know, the question is, Chuck, you and I talked about this before, what would happen, let's say, let's just take the hypothetical. Homeland Security buys up, let's use a hypothetical number, 1.6 billion rounds of ammunition of 9mm and 40 caliber strength, order thousands and thousands of fully automatic guns who will fire 40 caliber and 9mm shells, and then order and have delivered 2,700 mine-resistant armored personnel carriers who are fitted so that their tires are fitted for city streets. Now, let's just say the unthinkable would happen, and your director of the Department of Homeland Security decides to throw a coup and starts rolling these mine-resistant armored personnel carriers filled with Homeland Security personnel, all with fully automatic weapons of 9mm and 40 caliber variety, 1.6 billion rounds of ammo across this, and they start rolling into major cities and start trying to herd the populace into certain areas or shooting people. Would picking up a gun and firing back make you an enemy combatant?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think under Holder's interpretation, the answer would be yes.
The answer would be, the answer to that question is yes.
Well, guess what, Barry? I'm looking at the clock.
Oh, we are out of time again.
We are. Join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.